I'm delighted now to welcome Dave Marisch. He is news director at KSFR. He's an award-winning TV, radio, and print journalist for many news outlets, including Nightline and Al Jazeera English. And starting this afternoon at 5 o'clock, he will be doing a new hour-long show from 5 to 6 in the afternoon, Monday through Thursday, called Here and There. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here after being a listener since I moved to New Mexico.
Well, it's great to have you, and it's great to have you at KSFR. How did you get your start in news many years ago?
Well, when I was about 12 or 13 years old, I figured out that I was never going to be a major league athlete in any sport. So it seemed to me that being the play-by-play guy would be the next best thing. And so I wanted to get into radio as soon as I could. And when I went away to college, Williams College had a radio station, so I immediately volunteered and went on the air and started doing play-by-play of football and basketball. In small-town radio, you do everything. And so I started doing news as well as sports as well as disc jockeying. And I discovered that news sort of scratched every itch because it covers everything.
And throughout your career, you've done a lot of different things. Sports, the arts, hard news, news on location all over the world, science. It's kind of extraordinary that you were able to make that work throughout your career.
Let me say two things about that. First off, and this is something that I tell students and trainees, is that there's only one quality that you cannot do without if you want to be a journalist. And that quality is curiosity. You've got to have that itch to find out more, to know what's going on. And so I've always been a curious person, and I'm curious about all of those subjects that you named. But early in my career, 1967, I got my first major market job in New York at WINS, which was then the first and only all-news radio station in the States. And their star was one of my real heroes, a gentleman named Jim Gordon, who was their morning drive time anchor for the news. And in radio, morning drive time is the primest of prime times, which is, I think, why Radio Cafe is where it is, right in the middle of drive time. And he also was the play-by-play man for the football Giants, the hockey Rangers, and the basketball Knicks. And I said to him, everybody says to me, you've got to choose one or the other, and you're the one guy I know who does both news and sports. How do you do that? And his answer was perfect and succinct. He said, always know what you're talking about. And if you know what you're talking about, the audience will accept you. And they don't care whether it's you on sports or you on news, as long as what you're saying makes sense to them.
How did you go from radio to TV? You've done quite a bit of both, I guess.
Yes, I have. When I started out in radio, even then I had a beard. And television did not have beards, except, you know, Santa Claus at Christmas time. And so as I moved up the chain of being of radio and started working in New York, several television stations expressed some interest in me. And I wound up at Channel 11 in New York.
WPIX.
And the reason that they hired me with no television experience and a beard was that they were in danger of having their license seized by the FCC. Because if you remember, 1968 was the year that the Russians invaded Czechoslovakia. And WPIX had the story, but they were an independent station. They didn't have any video of the story. And so the news director decided, if you've seen one Russian invasion, you've seen them all. And he aired footage from Hungary in 1956 and supered it as Czechoslovakia.
Good heavens.
And he would have gotten away with it except that some staffer from the FCC was in New York and was watching television that night. And he saw this story, and he saw another super that said, via satellite. And he said, wait a minute, PIX doesn't have any satellites. And he starts looking intently at the screen, and there's a street sign, and it's in Magyar. And he immediately clicks, that's not Czechoslovakia, that's Hungary. And they, you know, were going to take the license away from Channel 11. That's a multi-million dollar proposition. So Channel 11 said, well, we're going to expand our news from a half an hour to an hour. We're going to fire that news director, and we're going to staff it with nothing but quality veteran journalists. And by then, I had been working in radio in New York as a reporter for about 5 years. And so they said to me, come work for us. And that's where I learned television.
And they didn't make you shave your beard?
No, and in fact, having a beard in television was so weird at that time that Time magazine, in their American Notes column, did an article about New York as the craziest city on earth, and the final evidence to prove that thesis was, and they got a guy on television with a beard.
Times have changed, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking to newsman Dave Marish. Now, you covered the terrorist siege at the 1972 Munich Olympics, and I'm sure you've been asked this many times before, but do you remember the moment?
Yes, I remember lots and lots of moments from that because it was such an extraordinary event. And as a reporting exercise, it was full of strange and wonderful things. The night before, the terrorists seized the Israeli dormitory at the Munich Olympics was the night of the first ever Soviet-Canadian ice hockey match. And Munich was one of the crow hop spots for the video link going back to Moscow. And so the Olympic Committee, knowing that there were lots of sports journalists covering the Olympics who would want to see the event, arranged to have a showing at the Olympic Press Center. And lots of athletes, mostly Canadians and Russians, broke out of the Olympic village to come to the press center to see this. And when the match was finally over at about 2 a.m. Munich time, these athletes, the gates were all locked to the village by then, so they all went over the fence. One of the Canadians, and the Canadian dorm was next door to the Israeli dorm, told me, we were climbing over the fence, and we noticed that there were other guys who were climbing over the fence. And what was interesting about them is that they were all carrying these huge gym bags, and they were all wearing sort of balaclavas, you know, hoodies. And we just thought, well, you know, it's more athletes. I don't know why they got these gym bags. Those, of course, were the terrorists who knew about the schedule, who figured out that there would be these athletes who would give them cover, and they used that cover to break into the Olympic Village and go to the Israeli quarters and start the siege. So I had just gotten into bed when the phone rang from New York saying, there's a bulletin, there are terrorists at the Olympic Village in Building 21. See what you can find out. So I slipped into my running suit, and I looked no more like an Olympic athlete then than I do today. But the Germans were very concerned about their reputation for being too dictatorial. And so they had very lax security for the Olympics, and part of that laxity allowed me to jog waving my press badge, which should not have gotten me into the village, And I get to Building 21, and I immediately notice two very important things. And remember, this is 1972. There were no cell phones. There were no mobile phones. So what I noticed is, number one, in the building across the courtyard from Building 21, I could see television cameras were already up on one of the balconies, so that I knew that World Television was already in position looking at the area under siege. I also noted that the nearest telephone booth was not only two blocks away, but didn't have line of sight to Building 21. So I made an executive decision that rather than shuttling back and forth to the phone booth, and every time I was away from my watching post, I couldn't see anything or know anything, I decided I would go back to the press center, where I knew that if there were television cameras, those feeds would be up on screen, and I had a telephone in front of me so that I could file report. And as it turned out, I reported literally about 50% of the time of the 36 hours from the beginning to the resolution of the siege, and I reported by looking at the three television screens that had a wide shot, a medium shot, and various close-up shots of Building 21. So that, in a way, in order to cover the story, I had to leave the story.
Very interesting. I mean, I guess we take these instantaneous technologies now for granted. And, I mean, what were the difficulties in not having those kinds of technologies at the time?
Well, it means that you always needed to know where a public phone would be for radio. For television, of course, everything was being shot on film that wasn't live video. And so that meant that even if you rushed the video, it was going to be developing for close to an hour before you could even start to edit it, much less put it on the air. And, of course, for foreign news, the video would often have to be air-delivered, which is why almost all of the coverage, for example, of the Vietnam War had a 24 to 48-hour time lag between the time it was actually shot on by a camera and the time that it appeared on your screen at home, because it had to be put on a plane, sent to New York or to the nearest bureau, say Tokyo, and edited there.
And that meant very high budgets for news departments.
Yes, that was expensive. That was inherently expensive, although salaries were lower then.
Now, you covered the civil rights movement in the 1960s and 70s, and I wondered if you could speak to the issue of being an objective journalist and covering essentially huge moral movements of the time.
Well, objectivity is, to me, an impossibility. We all acquire opinions. We all have experiences that shape our opinions and shape how we arrive at opinions and what we do about expressing our opinions. And so to pretend that you can wipe all of that out and go to a story as a tabula rasa is a pretense. And so I don't claim to or aspire to objectivity. What I try to do is to be fair and factual. And whatever my subjective opinions may be, I try and keep them out of the story. On the other hand, if you're first person reporting something, you do come to first-hand conclusions, and the best you can do there is to identify for your listener or for your viewer that this is me talking, I saw this, on the basis of that, I drew these conclusions. But there are other opinions, and here are some of them.
So what was it actually like covering, for example, race riots in New York, New Jersey, these places where you were reporting?
Well, that was, you know, my first approximation of being in a war zone was in Newark in 1968. And, you know, this was very strange because one of the really definitive facts about America is since 1865, we've had no wars here. And I think one of the things that has allowed American leaders to pursue warlike policies is that most of the voters at home have no idea what that involves. And even the best television reporting from the scene can only approximate that. So that going to the housing projects of Central Newark in 1967 and seeing snipers on the rooftops and seeing National Guardsmen rush to the scene, firing like the completely inexperienced semi-troops that they were, without allowing for the diminishing trajectory that you get when you fire, you know, almost directly upward, so that they would be firing at snipers on rooftops and they would be taking out all of the windows on the apartments two floors below the rooftop, because the trajectory of their bullet would diminish and wouldn't get where they were aiming. And they didn't have the experience, and they didn't, you know, have the command function to tell them, no, you can't aim at the guy on the rooftop. You got to aim above him if that bullet is to find him. So this was most strange. And to see warlike conditions in American neighborhoods was also beyond strange. It was horrifying.
Here we are, all these years later, in a militarized police situation, which you have reported on and talked to people who are reporting on. We've got Ferguson, Missouri. We've got innumerable instances of police brutality against black people, or stopping people for driving while black or walking while black. All these years after the Civil Rights Movement, after Martin Luther King's death, how do you understand what's going on, how far we've come, how far we haven't come?
Well, first off, there are two very different phenomena that you're talking about. One is militarization of civilian policing, and the other is discrimination, often in violent and oppressive ways, against people of color.
And they do intersect.
At their worst, yes. I mean, using militarized techniques to achieve that level of oppression is the worst of the worst. Why has America been unable to completely shed its racism? Boy, that's such a complex question. But all of the evidence suggests that we have not completely shed it. And this ranges from the fact that black people are much more likely to be stopped for any or no reason than by police than white people. They're much more likely to be arrested after being stopped than white people. They tend to get much heavier sentences for the same or similar crimes compared with white people. And there is no good, I mean, you can describe it, and you can give a kind of generic explanation that we react very hostily and often very unfairly to things that frighten us. And because African Americans are definably different looking than white people, they grow up in different neighborhoods, by and large, under different economic conditions, there is, among many white people, a kind of instinctive level of, if not fear, then certainly separation. It's what the social psychologists call otherization. There's me, and then there's those other people. And in that very otherness, there is an assumption of not just distinction, difference, but qualitative difference. And, you know, I think we have seen this in the political response to President Obama, who, whatever his failings as a president may be, he was received with blanket hostility by the Republican Party, who basically showed little interest in negotiating with him and compromising with him about anything serious. And I think that many Republicans felt it was safer to do this because Barack Obama is African-American. You can't deny that there's been tremendous progress. I grew up in the segregated South. Actually, one of the greatest things that ever happened to me was that when my parents moved, our family moved from Florida to Virginia, to Richmond. My parents bought literally the last house in the suburbs, and our back fence was the back fence, the limit of the suburban tract. And on the other side of the fence, there was a section of 16 40-acre farms that had come with a mule apiece to 16 African-American families in 1866 to 68. And one of those families lived directly behind us, and they became, they had seven siblings of my generation, and they were my best after-school friends. They were after-school friends because I walked two blocks to a brand-new elementary school built for the suburban tract, and they were bused 9 miles into the country to a three-room schoolhouse. And because they were my pals, maybe half of the kids in the suburban tract wouldn't play with me because I was an N lover. But growing up with, and from age five on, you know, that we would sleep, I would sleep at their house, they would sleep at my house. They had the first television in our neighborhood. I would go to their house every Thursday night to watch wrestling from Hollywood with them. Growing up surrounded by African-American people eradicated any sense of difference, of otherness for me. And so 15 years later, when I was on television in New York and was interviewing all kinds of people of all kinds of colors, they could tell and viewers could tell that there was no guard-all shield. There was no membrane of difference that separated me from them. They were just folks. I talked to them like I would talk to anybody. And within months of being on the television in New York, I had the highest Q rating, which is a rating of likability and credibility with minorities in the city. It helped make my career. I mean, I got promoted because I had, quote, penetrated those minority markets. Bill Clinton has that quality. If you watch Bill Clinton among people of color, he couldn't be more comfortable. He's quite comfortable putting his arm around them. He's quite comfortable walking, talking with them. Even people like Jimmy Carter, who's not a racist in any way, doesn't have that level, that comfort level with people of color. His mother did, but somehow he didn't transmit that, although he's a guy who wasn't one-on-one comfortable with a lot of people.
It's interesting that that's something that translates in some kind of, I don't know, unconscious, visceral way to the listeners and viewers. And if a reporter doesn't have that comfort level, you can kind of tell.
Yes, and the same with politicians. I mean, Clinton really is unique among white American politicians for his absolute comfort with people of all races, religions, and backgrounds. And questions of politics and ideology aside, just on a human one-on-one level, this was a huge advantage for him. And it's one of the reasons why people claim that he was really America's first black president.
We're talking to KSFR news director and veteran reporter Dave Marish about news reporting, talking about his career. We're going to talk in a moment about what's coming up on KSFR, the news show here and there that you will be producing 4 days a week, Monday through Thursday, starting this afternoon at 5 o'clock. Let's talk again for a moment. You were talking about Bill Clinton and you were talking about Barack Obama and the response to Barack Obama on the part of Republicans, which is almost synonymous with white Republicans, being racially tinged in the kind of blanket hostility. How do you compare that to the, if I remember correctly, also blanket hostility that Bill Clinton got when he became president?
Well, a lot of it has to do simply with the ways of American politics over the last 20 or 25 years, in which really uncivil personal attack and rigidly more than partisan but ideological positions that cannot and will not be compromised have come to dominate our political discourse. But in part because Clinton himself is a master politician. And because for all of his opposition to Clinton and for all of his attempts to impeach Clinton, the Republican House leader Newt Gingrich was also, like Clinton, a transactional politician to his fingertips. He wanted bills. Bill wanted bills. They would get together, snarl at one another perhaps, but at the end of the day, they would write a bill that each of their parties could be counted on sufficiently to support to get it passed. Barack Obama does not have those political skills. John Boehner is no Newt Gingrich. And John Boehner's Republican constituency is far more ideological and far more conservative than even the Gingrich revolutionaries of 1994. And so to actually conclude a political transaction, I'll give you this, you give me that, we're going to create a giraffe that's an ungainly beast, but by God, it's got four legs and a digestive system and will live. That seems to have faded away in favor of, I know I'm right and I know you're wrong, and for me to even give you 10% of your what you want would be wrong. And so we've reached a state of high political paralysis, which is, I think, extremely dangerous for the country and extremely counterproductive for the country and doesn't serve the interests of anybody except people who really want to paralyze government because, for ideological reasons, they think government and governance is a negative.
Which is really hard to understand when you think about our founding documents like the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution.
Well, how come people rail against socialized medicine when everybody has somebody in their family who benefits so greatly from Medicare?
Yeah.
This is ideology triumphing over massacring reality, reasonability.
Let's talk for a moment about how the news industry has changed since you started in the news. I mean, there's numbers of really huge developments. Some of them are technological developments, like, as we talked about, instantaneous transmission of information, like cell phones and the internet, the demise of newspapers and the business model of newspapers, also changes in regulation where there is no longer the necessity to provide public service if you want to get signals on the airwaves, and the demise of that, as has been written about eloquently by David Barsamian and others, has led to the cutting of budgets of broadcasters in terms of the news departments. Lots of changes. You've seen it all. You've been in the middle of it all.
It has changed almost completely. Let's start at the base level. When I got into the news business, it was a working class to middle class pursuit. And you didn't get into news to become rich and famous because almost nobody got to be either. And if you did, your chances of being famous were actually better than your chances of getting extremely rich. And so people went into news out of a kind of public service mentality, and that innate curiosity that I mentioned. People got into news because they wanted to find out what was going on and tell you about it. And they assumed, as Edward R. Murrow famously told Congress, that what they were doing, telling people about the real world as best they could investigate it, was the essence of democracy because it informed voters to make informed choices rather than simply ideological or principled choices. They made choices based on reality and decisions that had an impact on reality. In the 70s and 80s, several things happened. One, 60 Minutes demonstrated that you could have very high quality reporting and get a huge audience, but that was a less interesting lesson than you could make money. 60 Minutes became a highly profitable show. And news, which had been regarded as part of the cost of doing business, the FCC said you had a public service responsibility and you had to have a certain level of quality and a certain quantity of news and public affairs broadcasting in order to keep that very valuable license. Well, in the 80s, the Reagan administration completely did away with that, and there was no longer an outside compulsion or a qualitative monitor to make sure that the television networks and stations served the public. Also, they now had the opportunity that news could make money, and it could only make money if it attracted the largest possible audience. And although 60 Minutes demonstrated that there was no contradiction between the highest quality and the largest audience, unfortunately, most of the management and ownership of the media at that time thought that there was an either-or proposition. As a consultant told me shortly after I started anchoring the news at WCBS in New York, and he knew that I had an academic background. He said to me, you know, you've got to make a choice, Mr. Marish. You can either educate or entertain. And there was no question in my mind or his what the right answer was, entertain. And I said to him, you know, you've told me something really important about yourself. And he jumped back and he said, what do you mean? And I said, either you never went to school or you slept through class, because if you were awake, you would understand that education is entertaining and that that's what we're trying to do, is to present materials that educate and inform without putting our audience to sleep or offending them. But more and more, it was seen as an either-or. And so you started getting more and more people who were interested in making good television, because that drew eyeballs, rather than good news, which might or might not draw eyeballs. And as news became more profitable, salaries, particularly at the top end, went up. And so the people who got into television news got into it now no longer because they wanted to be a kind of public informant, but because they wanted to be rich and famous. They wanted to be not news people, but television people. And we have paid a serious price for that. And then, of course, along comes the Internet, and everything changes.
Let's talk for a moment about that educate and entertain either dichotomy or non-dichotomy. It's something I think about doing this show, because I do think those things can go together. And if you come from being an informed person and being a curious person, they fit naturally together. At the same time, I mean, the footage coming back from Vietnam in the 1970s was anything but entertaining, and it went on the news, and people watched it, and they were able to make political and decisions and decisions as citizens because of that. And people don't, it seems like, because of the way the news has been constructed since then, people are much more averse to seeing that kind of footage unless it's in an action film, you know, but they don't want to see it when it represents what's actually happening.
Well, what's actually happening is a war movie. And even in Vietnam, the overwhelming majority of reports from the front were simply scenes from a war movie. There were the great exceptions to that rule. Morley Safer's reporting, John Lawrence's reporting, both of them for CBS, which reported not only the boom boom, as we call it, but the context and the lives of the Vietnamese people who were living through and drawing conclusions from the warfare all around them. And it was that reporting that really was extraordinary and really did inform both the American people, and it certainly strengthened the anti-war movement, because it suggested that simply breaking things, which is what warfare does best, doesn't necessarily improve things. And that particularly for the people whose things are being broken, whose houses are being set on fire, whose fields are being mined, whose relatives and children are being killed, to them, the war is a plague. And whoever is responsible for promulgating war is not going to be a well-loved and cherished person. And this is a lesson that we did not absorb from Vietnam, and it's a lesson that we didn't really absorb quickly in Iraq or Afghanistan, that for the majority of the people there, who's winning, who's losing, what they represent, what they want, are all secondary to the primary thing, which is, I could get killed tomorrow. My children can't go to school because they can't leave the house. I don't have any more electric power. I don't have water in the house. We don't know about that because we, as I say, since the Civil War, thank goodness, have never had war here. And believe me, going to fight a war somewhere else is awful and stressful and demanding, but it's a walk in the park compared to living through war in your front yard, over your roof, coming in through your window.
And this is something that you know because you've been, among everything else, a war reporter and been, you were there for the Balkan Wars, you were there in Afghanistan, you reported on the Nicaraguan Revolution. And I've always wondered, as somebody who has spent 11 years sitting in this particular chair in the corner of the Santa Fe Baking Company and doesn't get out much, what draws you to that, what it's like? Do you have to have a certain kind of temperament to be a war reporter?
Oh, Lord, how I tried never to be a war reporter. For one thing, war is like another planet. It has its own set of rules. It has its own set of conditions, which are almost entirely different from everything about civil life. And frankly, it was not a planet that I ever wanted to visit. And I turned down war assignments and basically only went to visit post-war, because post-war is a return to civil society. And that's a planet that I know and that I'm interested in and that I enjoy reporting. Of course, by the end of the 20th century, the post-war tended to be a continuation of the war, which I learned the hard way by being there and seeing the warfare continuing even after the conventional wisdom was, oh, the war's over. And I'm not just talking about mission accomplished, but almost all of the real warfare in Bosnia was over by October 92, which is when I started going. But sporadic guerrilla warfare did continue in the Balkans through the year 2000 in Kosovo. And I was there for a lot of that and, you know, did see more than enough of that to where, I mean, one of the things that's changed for me is that violence can never be entertaining to me. I could not watch Breaking Bad. I could understand what a brilliant show it was, how well scripted, how incredibly well acted. But to me, one of its really vicious side points was that almost every episode had some very specific, you can't miss that this is mortal violence. Somebody would be strangled, and they would make sure that you heard the snap of the neck bone. No, I ain't going to watch that. I can't stand it. And that's a product of having been exposed, even somewhat tangentially, because as I say, I don't really consider myself a war reporter.
We're talking to Dave Marish. Now, after this long career doing some of the things we've talked about, many other things that we haven't even touched on in this program, you were here in New Mexico. You were news director for a local public radio station. You're starting a new show called Here and There. Let's talk about your choice to do this and your feelings about the importance of local media, local reporting.
Well, first off, I owe my job to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, because 1 week when you were away, my now co-news director, Zaylee Pullen, invited me to be a guest on the show to talk about global media. And after the show, George Weston, the station manager, called and said, we're looking for a news director. You sound like somebody who would be a great candidate for this job. And my response was, that may be more than I'm willing to take on, but how about if Zaylee and I combine on a job share for news director? And we wrote a contract that couldn't be turned down because it was so cheap. As remember how you, if you ever collected postage stamps, you would get stamps on approval, where they would send you a package of stamps for nothing, and then every subsequent package they said you had to pay full price for it. So George said, yes, let's try it. And I've had so much fun doing it. And now the prospect of Here and There is really exciting. And so thank you very much for providing the launch pad for my return to the news business and to the wonderful KSFR.
Well, I didn't do it. I was out sick that week, but thanks to the fabulous Zaylee Pollen. Local news has, it's kind of in an interesting position right now because newspapers are threatened. They're closing all over the place. Some places, even the free weekly paper is shutting down. Local radio news in a place like Santa Fe, state capital, has a very important role to fill. And it's for the local area, it's for the state, also potentially it's for the nation, especially since stories can be shared so very easily.
Well, yes, there's no question about that. Part of radio's advantage is that it's the least expensive news operation.
It's so true.
And therefore, it's likely to be the longest surviving. And yes, it has a vital mission to play. And in Santa Fe, that is both a statewide and a local mission. So there's a lot to cover here.
Tell us more about your hopes and plans for the upcoming program Here and There.
Well, I call it Here and There because that's where we're going for stories. We are going to do a healthy share of New Mexico stories here, and we're going to do an equally healthy share of national and global stories there. And one of the advantages of having spent now 55 years in the news business is that over that period of time, I've made a lot of contacts, I've gathered a lot of sources, and I've met a lot of colleagues. And I intend to mine all of that as best I can so that we are always talking to people who are at the front lines of major stories. And I will, for 48 minutes, debrief them. One, about the story, and two, about how they cover the story. Because particularly now, where so many of our listeners and viewers have an extremely skeptical view, and many have a frankly disrespectful and hostile view of the news, I think it's important to try and let people know how journalists work and how they learn what they, parentheses, think they, close parentheses, know. And so that'll be a major part of most all of my interviews. How do you cover this story, and how do you learn what you think you know?
And of course, you can only do that with journalists who, I mean, you know, think the way you do, as opposed to wanting to get into journalism for the glamour of it or for the money of it. I've never seen any of that glamour and money. I don't know where it lives, but I mean, there is...
Well, some people hit the jackpot, you know, and they get rich and famous, and they consistently are great reporters, and by golly, if I can get them on the show, I will.
Right, but there's such poor quality news that's part of all of our worlds. And, you know, we have a show on KSFR called Counterspin, which does an analysis of that every week, which I highly recommend because it's very valuable. Because there is this, I mean, I remember so many different times talking to people and saying, well, I heard that on the news. They put trust in that, even though the quality of it isn't always there. And the analysis of the news is such an important thing to be doing now, along with doing what we can do to change the news model so that there's more high-quality news.
Well, one of the things that, you know, one of the things that you enjoy and that here and there will enjoy is 48, 50 minutes of program time to explore not just the headlines, but the context behind the headlines, the where did this story come from, how did it get to where it is now, and where might it lead us, as well as all of the facts of the day, the headlines. So that having an hour's program on radio, less news time and promotion time, is a great, great advantage. And a lot of, I'm counting on the fact that a lot of report, one of the things that I learned, one of my maxims of the news business is, you never get to tell everything you know. Because you got limited time and limited space, and that's the way it is, and it's probably a good thing. But on our show, and on this show, people get time to tell you a lot of the things that they didn't have time to put into their copy or into their initial reports. And I think, I don't know many reporters who wouldn't regard that as a great opportunity.
And some of them will end up writing books, and for a lot of people, the only access they'll have to that book is the radio show they hear about the book.
This is true. This is true. But for people who are in the daily reporting business, books sometimes are a bridge too far. And in order to write a book, you kind of have to absent yourself from the front line. And a lot of the people I'm going to be talking to would rather cut off their foot than take a year off to write a book and absent themselves.
Well, Dave Marish, we are very much looking forward to having you in the afternoon, 5 to 6, Monday through Thursday. The show is called Here and There. Dave Marish is longtime veteran journalist and news director at KSFR. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Mary Charlotte, it's been a pleasure, and you do elicit wonderful conversations.
Well, thank you.